This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Susan Sontag was in North Vietnam during the war and in the Golan Heights when Israel was fighting with its Arab neighbors. But nothing she ever saw there compares, she says, to the misery and the desperation of Bosnia today. Susan Sontag visited Sarajevo in April for 2 weeks and just returned from a 6-week stay where she directed Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Sontag is best known as a writer of social criticism and essays. Her latest book, a novel, The Volcano Lover, is just out in paperback. When Susan Sontag went to Sarajevo, she found only 2 existing theaters and no functioning theater companies. She held auditions for 3 days and assembled a cast and crew of Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. Sontag told me why she chose to mount that play in that place.
I have to admit that it was so obvious to me that I didn't even think about it. It is, although it was written, 40 years ago, I guess. It was first performed in Paris in 1952, if I'm not mistaken. It seems as if it was written for Sarajevo. It's about abandoned people, weak, vulnerable people, waiting for something to happen that they go on hoping against hope will happen, and yet it's perfectly clear it's not going to happen, and that's the situation of the people of Sarajevo.
How would you describe the Sarajevo that you saw in the spring and the Sarajevo you just returned from? How have conditions changed between those 2 months?
I would say, given that context, but also given other things as well, that the mood is much darker. I think in April people still did have hope. They said over and over again, this is unjust. This is totally unjust. We are a state that has been recognized by all the European states and above all by the United States. Recognition means respect for territorial borders. We can't believe the international community, and particularly Europe or the United States, is going to let us down. Please go and tell the world what's happening to us. That's what they were saying in April. By early July, when I got there, they knew that the world knew, and they felt, no, we're not going to be helped. The mood was much, much darker, full of despair. I can't tell you how miserable and indignant people are, but mostly they're just extremely depressed. They're heartbroken. They keep saying over and over again, but we're part of Europe, but we were recognized, but this is unjust, but the Serbs are war criminals and they've committed all these atrocities. But doesn't everybody know about it? The concentration camps, the policy of rape, the continued shelling of the city, which, by the way, even when you read about there being a ceasefire, that doesn't mean that there's no shelling or sniping. It just means that there's less than there is in a normal day. In the first part of the time that I was there in July and August, as many as 3,000 mortar shells fell in the central city. It meant that, you know, so I don't know, 20, 30 feet away from you, somebody was getting killed almost any place you were.
You certainly are describing the desperate conditions in Sarajevo and describing the deep depression that many of the people feel. How are they able to go on with their life? How much of a life do they really have?
Well, you know, as many people have said in literature and in ordinary life, people get used to anything. This is both a horrible and an exalting aspect of human nature. You would be surprised at the degree of normality there. I remember when I went in April, I couldn't believe that I saw children playing on the streets. And I met parents, and I said, how do you let your children go out on the streets? Because something like 3 or 4 children are minimum are killed every day by sniper bullets or by mortar shells fragments. And they said, look, you can't keep your children indoors after 16 months. You can keep them indoors for 2 weeks or a month or 2 months, but life goes on. And anyway, no one is safe in an apartment. During the time I was there just now in July and August, I know a number I remember I went to see someone I know, and he told me that the woman in the apartment just above his had been shot. Have been hit and killed by a sniper bullet the night before. I was sitting in his living room, you know, one floor below, around the same time that his neighbor had been killed the night before. So it isn't even a question of staying in or going out. People become very fatalistic, and there is a lot of normal life there. I met a lawyer, for instance, a boyfriend of someone that was working with me in the theater, and I said, oh, I mean, even I, who know the place very well now, I said, oh, are there court cases here now? And he said, of course there are. There are sitting courts. I said, are there divorces? He said, more than ever. He said, because people get married very fast now. They don't have sort of normal courtship activities. They can't go to the movies because there are no movie theaters. They can't sit in the park because they'll get killed. So they get married very fast, and there are a lot of six-month divorces. What's amazing is an awful lot of what you would call normal daily life goes on, except it's Russian roulette. It's a shooting gallery, except you could be killed at any single moment of the day or night, wherever you are, and you have in almost all places in the city, including the one functioning hotel, which is where I stayed, no water at any time, no electricity at any time, and very, very little food.
What precautions did you take to make sure that, not make sure, but to try to protect yourself against the sniper bullets?
None.
None. Why not?
Because I think I cannot work with people there wearing a flak jacket. I will tell you, I do own one. Because in order to get on a UN plane, which is the only way you can get in or out of the city, is by a plane run by the United Nations, which carries soldiers or cargo, it's a rule that you have to wear a flak jacket. So I actually possess one of these things. I wore it to get on the plane in Zagreb, and I got off the plane with it at the Sarajevo airport, which is controlled by the Serbs. But there's a little UN revetment, and I wore it into the city, and I checked into the hotel, and I left it there, and I put it on again 6 weeks later when I went out to the airport to get on the plane. That may seem very foolish, but I felt that I could not come to rehearsal, sit with my actors wearing armor when no one in the city has a flak jacket, and no one is protected in the way all foreigners, that is journalists or anybody visiting the city, is. So that was a moral decision. I felt like I absolutely could not do that, that I'm putting myself in a different position. No one told me to do that except one actor about 4 days into the rehearsal process said to me, of course I wouldn't mind if you wore a flak jacket, but I do appreciate that you don't. But that was the only person who ever said to me that noticed it, but I'm sure everybody noticed it. I felt it was a question of principle, not to live differently from the way they live. I already am in a totally different position. I can leave. They can't. If the city is totally sealed, no one can leave.
Do you get used to the sounds of gunfire?
If you're asking me if I was afraid, of course I was afraid. And so was everybody else there. I mean, there are few people there who are so depressed that they become, in fact, suicidal. You hear stories about people just strolling, and it's said of those people they were looking for their bullet. Because a lot of people, particularly older people, are in the most terrible despair, and they hold up less well under these circumstances of terrible privation. I mean, most people spend a good part of their day ensuring that their toilet can flush. Because there are springs and public taps in the city, but everybody has to go out and get this water in plastic, plastic jerry cans. And then, since most of Sarajevo is new and modern, haul it up 10 or 15 stories, because obviously, since there's no electricity, no elevator works. And that's what they're doing. A third or half of the day is risking their lives to get water, at least half of which goes to keep the toilet flushing so that their bathrooms don't become cesspools. And that's so demoralizing.
What was it like to work with a cast and crew that I'm sure were hungry a lot of the time, certainly were frightened a lot of the time? Probably many of them didn't even feel well because of the conditions they were living under.
Yeah, what it was is that I was pretty easygoing at the start. And maybe I was easygoing all the way through, keeping my fingers crossed that I'd still get a good result at the end. One or two people said to me, who came in and watched rehearsals, it's funny, I've never told this to anybody, said, you're too nice to them. Don't you know a director has to scream at people now and then and be terrifying and tyrannical?
Are you that kind of a director anyway?
Well, first of all, I'm neither that kind of director nor that kind of person, but I knew that I couldn't scream at these people even if I wanted to. They were so gallant and so tired. And they all had terrible stories, and so, yes, I was feeling full of sympathy for them and worrying about their problems. I was bringing them food from the hotel. I'm feeding them every morning. I was taking rolls from the dining room in the hotel because, I mean, however inadequate the food in the hotel was, it was still better than what they were getting. We did have our spam and rice and rolls and whatever.
I was going to ask you, what kind of food were you able to eat there?
Well, it wasn't very much, but it was more than what they had. I noticed how tired they were because they would sit down or lie down every time I stopped the rehearsal for 1 minute to give a correction or suggestion. They'd immediately all drop into chairs or drop to the floor. And actors don't do that. I mean, they stay in place when you talk to them, unless it goes on and on and on. And I wasn't stopping them for more than a minute or two.
So they had no stamina, really?
They had no stamina at all. And the character of Lucky in Beckett's play is a figure of a man who carries a lot of suitcases. He's the figure of a burdened person. And needless to say, the suitcases that the actor playing Lucky in my production was carrying were all empty. And he was having a very hard time carrying empty, very light suitcases, two or three.
They were
made of cardboard, and they were still an effort for him to carry.
My guest is writer Susan Sontag, and she's talking to us from her home in New York about directing Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. She just returned from a six-week stay. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and director Susan Sontag. How multi-ethnic was the cast and the crew? Were there Muslims, Croats, Serbs working together on this play?
Absolutely, and I made no effort to choose people on that basis, but gradually as I got to know them, I found that I had, you know, absolutely a mix. I had people who were completely Serb, completely of Muslim origin, and completely Croat, and I had more than half the people who were of mixed parentage, a Muslim mother and a Serb father, or Croat mother and a Muslim father, etc. It was because that's what Sarajevo is. And one of the most interesting facts about Sarajevo that I know is in the year before the war started, in April 92, 60% of the marriages in Sarajevo were intermarriages. I think that tells you a lot about the city. The word Muslim is very misleading. And I think awakens a lot of stereotypes. The Bosnian Muslims really have the worst of both worlds. They're regarded as Muslims by the so-called West, that is Western Europe and North America, and they're not regarded as Muslims by the Arabs, by the people of the Middle East, of societies which do still have are still dominated by religious communities. To put it in its simplest terms, the Muslims of Sarajevo, the people I know, are no more Muslim than I'm Jewish. That is to say, they are people of Muslim origin whose families stopped being religious several generations ago. When I would ask people who were of Muslim origin, well, how much religious observance is there or was there in your family? They would always speak of their great grandparents or their grandparents. I never met anybody whose parents were even observant. And insofar as they were observant, it was a very generic, weak form of religious observance. For instance, nobody I met in Sarajevo, and I'm talking about people who would say they were of Muslim origin, knew the difference between Sunni and Shiite Islam, which is the fundamental difference in Islam. I mean, it's like the difference between Catholic and Protestant. You would never, if you said somebody who was a Christian and you said, are you Protestant or Catholic, they wouldn't know what you meant. These people weren't even aware of that distinction. So I think as far as Sarajevo goes in the urban centers of Bosnia, what we're talking about are Christian Slavs who were converted three or four centuries ago when it became a Turkish province, and who always had, at most, a very diluted, generic form of religious observance, which in urban areas disappeared several generations ago.
What language, then, was the play done in?
The play was done in Bosnian, because that's the language the actors speak, although many of them do speak English. They don't act in English. And anyway, the audience, I want this play to be understood by the audience. That may seem odd to you, but it's really not odd. I mean, Arthur Miller went to Shanghai and directed a production of Death of a Salesman. He certainly directed it in Chinese, not in English. So just a theater director, like an opera director with any experience and any international experience, knows how to do this in a foreign language. All you need is an interpreter, And I used one of the actors who was bilingual as my interpreter. And I could communicate privately with most of the actors in English, but the language in which they spoke the text was Bosnian. And what I did was I had two copies of the script. I had an English language copy of Mr. Beckett's script enlarged, and I wrote the Bosnian word by word above the English, and then I had the copy of the Bosnian text, and I wrote the English above it word by word. And after about 2.5 weeks, I could recite the play for you in Bosnian because I heard it so many times. And I always knew what they were saying, and I could say, you know, that line you're saying too fast or not expressively or whatever. It's no different, really, from opera directing, which also takes place in many languages.
Tell us how the play was received.
With enormous enthusiasm. I think it was a big event there. It was a big event that a foreigner came and wanted to stay there and work and do something. It was a big public event. I should add that there is no money economy there. The only money economy is a black market economy, and the currency is Deutschmark. So I was not paid any salary or any expenses. Neither were the actors or any of my crew paid, and the tickets are free. Whatever cultural activity takes place there is not salaried. You have to imagine an economy in which a pack of cigarettes, I'm talking about Deutschmarks because that's the only currency that counts, a pack of cigarettes is 10 marks. The salary of a surgeon at the hospital is 3 marks a month. So a little over 3 months' work will get you one pack of cigarettes. So everybody who's working there is working for free.
If you hadn't been in Bosnia, would you feel so strongly and so clearly about what you feel that country needs and the responsibilities of the outside world toward that country?
I'll be absolutely honest with you. Probably I wouldn't, but that would be my failure of imagination and knowledge. I think I do feel it this strongly because I have been there. I won't say that I don't. But on the other hand, there are people like Joseph Biden, for instance, Senator Biden, who did actually come there once for 24 hours, but I don't think he saw anything that changed his mind or influenced him. I think he came there with the views that he has already had and subsequently continued to eloquently express. So I think that people who have really thought about this question and are attentive can reach exactly the same conclusions. But I won't pretend that I might have reached the same conclusions had I not fully turned my attention to the place and decided to go there.
Let me get some specifics from you if I can. You support intervention in Bosnia. What would be the targets? What would be the political solution that you would support?
I would support the lifting of the siege of Sarajevo as a demand, among others. The recognition of a viable state of Bosnia, one that could survive, not some kind of sort of apartheid state, which is just what a sort of apartheid mini state of so-called Muslims. Serbia can be pressured into making concessions. The Serbs have total contempt for the United States, and they know that nothing's going to happen, and they thumb their nose at the United States. But whenever there is the slightest pressure, they yield, and they would continue to yield to pressure. Listen, I don't want a single Serb or Croat civilian to die. I'm not bloodthirsty, and by the way, neither are most of the Sarajevans. But I think a combination of no foreign policy has credibility unless there is an intention to use force, a possibility of using force, and there are countless statements by Karadzic and Milosevic and Mladic that show they have complete contempt for the United States. They say things like, "Oh yeah, sure, you bomb our positions on the hills of Sarajevo, we're going to bomb New York." They laugh.
You were against the war in Vietnam. Why do you support U.S. intervention?
To stop a war. I still consider myself an anti-war activist, among other things, among many, many other things. I believe intervention is necessary to stop genocide, to stop this war, to stop this country and these people from being exterminated. There will be 2 million Bosnian refugees, if we're lucky that there are that many who survive. The most of the people in Sarajevo don't fit these ghetto apartheid categories. Where does someone who's half Muslim and half Croat go? Where does someone who's half Serb and half Croat go? Where does someone who, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? This is to stop murder. It's not because I've suddenly discovered the virtues of war.
Will you go back to Sarajevo soon?
I'm going back in 4 weeks.
Well, for another play?
Well, I'm going back to look in on my play, which will have been running continually until I get back and do a little sort of scotch tape and repairing of various, you know, I mean, any play crumbles a little around the edges when the director is gone for too long. But mainly, I'm going back because I'm so attached to the place, and I want to see friends and bring people. I mean, one of my actors has a heart problem and can't get medicine. That's a reason for going back to bring this woman her heart medicine, to bring batteries to people so they can listen to their Walkman, to bring flashlights and candles, to bring a salami to a person who hasn't seen a salami in 17 months. Say hello to friends. I'll stay there maybe 10 days and try to stop thinking about them round the clock and go back sometime in the winter if there still is a Sarajevo and direct another play, probably a play of Chekhov, I think.
Do you know which one?
Well, I'm very torn. The Three Sisters sounds like a play. I mean, Chekhov also, the mood of Chekhov also fits Sarajevo. A lot of plays fit Sarajevo.
I thank you so much, Susan Sontag, for joining us today on Fresh Air and giving us some of your valuable time.
Thank you very much.
Writer Susan Sontag talking about her experiences directing Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.